From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Attorney General William Barr skipped a hearing of the House Judiciary Committee this morning, despite threats from Representative Gerald Nadler, the committee chair, that Barr could face a contempt of Congress citation for doing so. Chairman Nadler, who's a Democrat from New York, opened the brief hearing with harsh words for the attorney general, calling on him to, as Nadler put it, stand up to the president in defense of the country.
I do not know what Attorney General Barr will choose. I do not know what my Republican colleagues will choose. But I am certain that there is no way forward for this country that does not include a reckoning with this clear and present danger to our constitutional order. History will judge us for how we face this challenge. We will all be held accountable in one way or the other. And if he does not provide this committee with the information it demands and the respect it deserves, Mr. Barr's moment of accountability will come soon enough.
NPR's national security editor Phil Ewing is here with us now. Phil, good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
So this was a pretty unusual hearing. There was an empty chair for Barr, and it was essentially just two angry speeches, one from Chairman Nadler, we heard some of it there, and another by the ranking Republican on the committee. Just describe the scene for us this morning.
Well, it was what both sides called a spectacle, or intended to be a spectacle. For Democrats, they wanted it to make a point that they're trying to do this constitutional oversight, as they call it, that you heard the chairman talk about just now in that clip. For the Republicans, led by Congressman Doug Collins of Georgia, they said it's a political circus. They called it theater. One member of Congress brought a bucket of fried chicken to make the point that Barr is a chicken for not showing up. Mm. He also had a porcelain chicken that kind of looked like he might have taken it off his shelf in his grandmother's house or something like that, Steve Cohen from Tennessee. And this was, in the view of both sides, about making a political point. But the point they're trying to make, Republicans and Democrats, obviously is quite different.
Okay, let's hear from the ranking member, Doug Collins, now.
To say we want it to look like an impeachment hearing because they won't bring impeachment proceedings. That's the reason. Take whatever you want to take. You can go out and have press conferences. You can state it from this dais. You can state whatever you want to have. But the reason Bill Barr is not here today is because the Democrats decided they didn't want him here today.
Now, there is a lot at stake here. We heard Chairman Nadler say he's planning to hold Barr in contempt. This is also a fight about trying to get the fully redacted version of the Mueller report, which the attorney general is resisting. Just walk us through how that process would work if it's going to happen.
Well, if the Justice Department continues not to give Jerry Nadler the material he says he wants and also access to the attorney general, according to what Nadler said today, he will begin the work with the members of his committee toward that end. The first thing they would do is vote on whether or not to issue a subpoena for Barr. They control the majority on this panel, and they probably could get that in the same way the panel authorized Jerry Nadler to issue that earlier subpoena for the full Mueller report, which the Justice Department is not giving. If the Justice Department doesn't comply, then Jerry Nadler could escalate the matter not only to the members of his committee, but to the members of the full House, which is controlled by Democrats and led by the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. They would decide whether or not to vote on a citation for the Attorney General for being in contempt of Congress. It isn't clear whether that will happen or how long it would take going forward. The Justice Department has said that it wants to be responsive to Congress, that it wants to deal with lawmakers of both parties, but it doesn't want to play this game. It doesn't want to get into what it calls meritless kind of tit-for-tat political situations. And it isn't clear right now whether cooler heads are going to prevail and these two sides will back away, or whether, as you heard the Republican ranking member say there, Democrats really want to escalate this. They want to have a fight for the sake of their own political supporters, although one that would be short of, as we also heard Doug Collins say, actually bringing an impeachment case against the president himself in the House.
Phil, why are the Democrats being so careful about subpoenas, about that? You know, they're threatening them, but they're not actually issuing the subpoena or contempt of Congress or even impeachment of Barr. They're not ready to go there yet.
That's a great question. I think one reason is they themselves agree that these are relatively serious matters. In the traditional way that the game is played in Washington, you don't need to issue a subpoena to get information or get testimony from the administration. But in these times of greater political tension, that becomes necessary. There's also a political benefit, I think Democrats would argue, in being tough on the Trump administration, being tough on Bill Barr, this attorney general. And also, there's not that much that Congress can do in practical terms to enforce its desires. So let's say these talks do break down, these tensions do reach another flashpoint, the Congress holds Bill Barr in contempt. What does that mean in practical terms? It's embarrassing for him. Potentially, it's bad. A lot of people will cluck their tongues and pull their beards, but he'll keep his job. The world will continue to spin. And so the options they have in terms of actually enforcing their will aren't as strong as they might prefer and won't necessarily get exactly what they want from the Attorney General Bill Barr from the Trump administration.
All right. That's NPR's national security editor, Phil Ewing in Washington. Phil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And as more states consider legalizing recreational marijuana, two new studies have found links between marijuana use and psychosis. The most recent, published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, found that marijuana edible users may face a greater risk of psychiatric side effects like hallucinations. The lead researcher in that study served as a consultant on a high-profile murder case 5 years ago when a Colorado man shot his wife to death and blamed an edible for his actions. Reporter Lori Jane Gleha from Rocky Mountain PBS has the story.
Spiraled barbed wire, layers of metal fencing, and a couple of tall, heavy gates surround the outside of the Bent County Correctional Facility in Las Animas, Colorado. It's where convicted killer Richard Kirk lived early on in his three-decade sentence for murdering his wife in 2014.
I know without any doubt that if I did not eat that marijuana, my wife and family would still be together today. I know that with a certainty.
He's wearing a baseball cap and black plastic glasses. He has a scruffy goatee. And he's eager to tell the story of his first encounter with a legal marijuana edible.
That was the worst decision I ever made in my life.
When Colorado first legalized recreational cannabis in 2014, Richard Kirk was addicted to Vicodin. He says he wanted an alternative to Vicodin for his back pain, so he tried a legal store-bought edible. He had had a pot brownie in college, but this was different. It took a while to kick in, like at least an hour, so he nibbled some more. And then things got weird.
I all of a sudden, almost instantaneously, just felt like this is a feeling I've never felt before.
I just lost myself. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what the threat was. I didn't know if I was the threat. I didn't know.
Kirk and his wife did have a history of financial and marital problems. He eventually pleaded guilty to second-degree murder before a jury ever had the chance to hear his edible defense in court. Whether you believe his story or not, Colorado regulators did make significant changes after the murder. They limited how much of the psychoactive ingredient, THC, each marijuana edible could contain, and restricted serving sizes.
How's it going? Hey, Jess.
Dr. Andrew Monti is a marijuana researcher and sits on the state's Retail Marijuana Public Health Advisory Committee. He has new evidence linking edibles to psychiatric complications.
Not everybody that takes an edible agent is going to have hallucinations. Many, many people do take it and take it safely. And so we need to understand and respect that. But again, the risk seems to be much higher for edible agents than it does for smoked agents.
Monti has conducted 10 studies since 2009 on cannabis and health. In his latest study, he examined about 2,600 marijuana-attributable patient visits to the emergency department at UC Health University of Colorado Hospital between 2012 and 2016. The number of those patient visits made up less than 1% of all visitors to the ER, but
there seemed to be a disproportionate number of visits associated with edible cannabis products compared to other products.
And acute psychiatric complications like hallucinations occurred at a greater rate for edible users when compared with patients who smoked the drug. Monti says the effects of edibles are, quote, unpredictable, and the risk seems to outstrip the benefits of their use. Dr. Monti also worked as a paid consultant for Kirk's defense team early in his case.
This gentleman had no history of any psychiatric disease. He ate a edible agent and unfortunately had incredibly bad delusions and killed his wife.
Dr. Kerry Franzen is an associate professor of clinical pharmacy at the University of Colorado. We asked her to explain why edibles may have a different effect on the body when compared to inhaled marijuana.
With edibles, there's a delay in getting the drug into the system because it has to be absorbed. That can take anywhere from 30 minutes to a few hours. And how much gets in can vary depending on what somebody ate that day, if they're on another drug. There's a lot of different factors.
In 2010, Dr. Franzen published the results of a cannabis study in the Netherlands, looking closely at the correlation between THC and symptoms of psychosis.
It seems that the risk is increased with the higher doses and the higher concentrations that are achieved in an individual.
While doctors warn of the potential unpredictability of edibles, pot proponents say consumers have used them responsibly for years with few problems. Richard Kirk says he's interested in learning more about new research, but he knows he won't be getting out of prison anytime soon. For NPR News, I'm Lori Jane Gliha, Denver, Colorado.
President Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, heads to prison on Monday to serve a 3-year sentence for, among other things, paying hush money to women who, right before the 2016 election, threatened to expose affairs they said they had with President Trump. Unlike Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, who's also serving prison time, Cohen has been cooperative with investigators. So what exactly have we learned from Michael Cohen about the president? Washington Post reporter Matt Zapatosky authored the analysis and commentary for the Post's new book, The Mueller Report. He joins us now. Hi, Matt.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And how central to Mueller's investigation was Michael Cohen?
Well, central's a tough word. Mueller described him as someone who provided testimony or evidence spanning kind of the whole scope of his investigation. So in that sense, he's central. He's also central in the sense that he speaks to both aspects of the investigation, the obstruction piece. A lot of the conduct that Mueller described had to do with obstruction related to Michael Cohen. And the Russia piece, he describes kind of business dealings with people in Moscow. But it's not as if he sort of came away or left Mueller with some kind of smoking gun. He provided a lot of testimony to the core topics of their investigation, but he was also a witness who had significant credibility problems and maybe didn't give them what you would hope, the president's fixer, a guy who called himself the president's fixer, might be able to.
Well, and of course, he was in front of the public in February when he testified before Congress. And one of the things he said is that he didn't have direct evidence that President Trump knew about his son, Don Jr.'s meeting with Russians at Trump Tower in June of 2016. But he did recall overhearing this.
And I recall Don Jr. leaning over to his father and speaking in a low voice, which I could clearly hear, and saying, "The meeting is all set." And I remember Mr. Trump saying, "Okay, good. Let me know."
Did that lead anywhere?
Yeah, this is the problem with Michael Cohen. It's just all innuendo. And I overheard this and I intuit this and I thought this. I thought Trump wanted me to do this. I thought this is what this means. And that's tough for investigators, right? You can't come to a definitive conclusion based on that. And that's what Mueller seemed to be running into with him.
Cohen also said he overheard Trump taking a phone call from associate Roger Stone. Here he is.
Mr. Stone told Mr. Trump that he had just gotten off the phone with Julian Assange, and that Mr. Assange told Mr. Stone that within a couple of days, there would be a massive dump of emails that would damage Hillary Clinton's campaign. Mr. Trump responded by stating to the effect, "Wouldn't that be great?"
How has that played out?
Yeah, now that one is a little more clear, right? This isn't him interpreting conversations. He claims to be hearing the whole thing. But I think we all know now that Robert Mueller could not conclude that the president coordinated with Russia. That would have been critical on that point because it kind of showed advanced knowledge and it kind of showed a willingness to accept the help of WikiLeaks, who Robert Mueller says got these emails from Russia. But that sort of itself is not a crime. Robert Mueller describes how the Trump campaign was eager and willing mm-hmm. to accept Russian help, but that itself sort of not a crime. Interesting nonetheless, though.
There was news from the Wall Street Journal last week that Cohen, in a phone conversation he didn't know was being recorded, said he wasn't really guilty of some of the financial crimes that he had pled guilty to. What's your sense of that? Is he just trying to maybe say he can provide further information and get less prison time later?
Yeah, so Cohen has really been almost on a tour to try to get less prison time. He got his report date to prison, which now is going to happen next week, but he got that delayed so he could testify before Congress. In the intervening months, there were kind of leaks about what other valuable information he might have, and sparked kind of prosecutors to re-talk to him. But now he's at the end of the road. He really, really doesn't want to go to prison. I think he feels like, gosh, he cooperated. Even if he did some wrong, he shouldn't be going to prison for 3 years. But the only way to stay out now is to provide some new explosive piece of evidence that's really going to help prosecutors in a case, so they would then move to have the sentence reduced. And it just doesn't seem at this juncture like that's likely.
Well, then they might wonder, why didn't you tell us that before?
Well, exactly right. And I mean, he had some credibility issues with them in his initial conversations. I think they've said he lied to them initially until he kind of came clean. And you would think by this point, you know, they've raided his home, his mm-hmm. office, hotel he was staying at. They talked with him at such length. What more could he possibly have to tell prosecutors?
That's Washington Post reporter Matt Zapatosky. Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, now to some new technology that could be coming to an airport near you. JetBlue passenger Mackenzie Fagan was surprised recently when she went to board her flight at New York's Kennedy Airport. And instead of handing over her boarding pass to a gate agent, she was asked to look into a facial recognition screen for approval to board the flight. JetBlue says this is part of a program being run in cooperation with Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, which is being expanded to more airports. Now, most of her fellow passengers didn't seem bothered by the difference, but Fagan was. She joins us now. Mackenzie, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
So just tell us what happened. You had no idea that you wouldn't need a boarding pass to get on the plane?
That's correct. Everything else was normal. I showed up. I had my boarding pass on my phone. And then once I started heading towards the gate with my group number, I saw that there were three different lanes and that the gate agents were channeling people into the lane. And at that point, I saw that they were looking at a camera, and then this plastic gate that was in front of the lane would swing open and they would be allowed down the jet bridge. At first, I thought that maybe this was a program for people who had global entry, which I do. And then I noticed that everybody was going through it, and that seemed like it couldn't just encompass people with global entry. So when it was my turn, somebody channeled me into a gate, told me to look at the camera. A couple seconds later, the gate opened, and I was on my way, wondering what had just happened.
And you weren't feeling like, oh, this is so great, how convenient. I just walked through without having to show my boarding pass. You were like, uh-oh, what is this about?
I was just curious and confused about how it worked and if I had consented to this.
So what did JetBlue say when you asked them about this?
So at first, JetBlue issued sort of the standard non-apology apology that celebrities are used to issuing when they behave badly, which is, oh, I'm sorry that made you feel uncomfortable. We didn't mean to make you feel uncomfortable. You can opt out. And then I followed up with some further questions. I was like, how does this actually work? Surely you're matching my image to something. How does JetBlue know what mm-hmm. I look like? And that's when they said, we receive that information from existing CBP holdings. And that's when I really flipped out.
Why?
Because I did not authorize, or at least I was not aware that I had authorized the government to share my biometric data with a privately held corporation. And I should note that I do have TSA PreCheck. I do have global entry. So I have made the decision to hand over my biometric data in order to expedite the immigration procedure whenever I come back into the country. But I didn't recall authorizing the government to share that data with corporations. So I questioned that again on Twitter. I was like, did I consent to this? Who holds my data? How long does JetBlue have it? And then JetBlue customer service backpedaled pretty quickly. And they were like, oh, just to be clear, no, JetBlue doesn't have that data. We just send this information to the Department of Homeland Security and the CBP.
So does it surprise you that much that this was going on, given that there are at this point cameras everywhere, especially in an airport? And as you say, in certain parts of the airport, you actually do use facial recognition software to get from point A to point B.
Right. I mean, I think we are largely desensitized to facial recognition technology at this point. It just seems like the inevitable slow trudge into a world where we have no personal privacy and our biometric data belongs to the government and to corporations. I actually think maybe I wouldn't have noticed it or questioned it if I hadn't been doing some research and reporting on facial recognition for my own show. But because I guess it was fresh in my mind, as I passed through that gate, I was like, that's different.
So from now on, what are you going to do? Are you going to go back to the old boarding pass line? Or are you going to continue to use facial recognition to get on the plane?
Well, they do say that you can opt out, but actually, you can't really opt out. At the gate, you can choose not to go through the facial scanner. But your information has already been pulled and compiled into a data set that matches the flight manifest, from what I understand. So if you can't opt out at the time when you buy your ticket, then opting out at the scanner doesn't really do any good. Your data has already been pulled and is being held somewhere in a cloud-based server run by some corporation. So I don't know. I guess maybe I'll opt out just to be a conscientious objector. But it sounds like the train has already left the station. This is being implemented nationwide, from what I understand. The Trump administration wants it in effect by the end of the year. So the fact that there was no period of public comment, I find very distressing. But I'm not sure that my personally opting out is going to do much.
You know, the thing that this brings up is something that we talked with an author about recently, which is that in each piece of technology that gets added to our lives, we only think about the convenience factor and how it makes our lives better. We don't think about the cost. So you're obviously thinking about both here. Thank you so much for joining us, Mackenzie.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Freelance writer Mackenzie Fagan, and we've got JetBlue's statement about this at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, EmberWave. EmberWave, a revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. EmberWave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
Conservative commentator Stephen Moore is out of the running for a seat on the Federal Reserve Board. President Trump made the announcement on Twitter today, and it's the second person tapped by the president to drop out of consideration for the job. Joining us now is Robin Farzad. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, good to speak with you.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Moore had said some pretty unsavory things about women in the past. He follows the pizza executive Herman Cain, who withdrew his name not too long ago. What tipped the scales here against Moore?
Yeah, you had a bunch of Senate Republicans outspoken of their fact that they were going to be not comfortable with kind of rubber stamping this guy's nomination, even though he was out there telling the world that it was going to fly through the Senate. But maybe his most fatal flaw was coming out, I think, in a Bloomberg interview and disagreeing with this president's idea that the Federal Reserve should cut rates right now in this economic expansion. Maybe that was the death knell for him.
All right. Well, so bad news for the president, who had wanted to put his stamp on the Fed with both Cain and Moore. But Robin, before this story broke, I was actually planning to talk with you about another story. The USDA this week gave Philip Morris International the green light to sell a new tobacco product that uses heat, not a flame, to release a nicotine aerosol. What is this thing?
That's right. Heat, not burn. It's the IQOS. It's a snazzy-looking electronic pen thingamajiggy that heats a mini stubby cigarette. You're not getting the full combustible hit and carcinogens of a traditional cigarette that you light on fire, but everything else is, pun intended, up in the air.
How is it different than an e-cigarette, which is already on the market?
Well, you know, you're actually using tobacco in this case, a smaller cigarette, and you are involving some element of heat. And Philip Morris, USA, insists that it is safer than the combustible cigarette, but public health advocates, they're skeptical. And the FDA, if you notice in its ruling, isn't outright declaring that the IQOS is safer than traditional cigarettes as much as it is a useful crutch to quit smoking.
It's interesting. The FDA has totally been going after the makers of e-cigarettes, mostly for advertising to kids and that sort of thing. I don't know. Isn't it a little odd to see the FDA now approving another device that is, you know, a little bit different but kind of the same?
It is bizarre, and I've handled one of these. It's a beautiful device, very much like something you'd see in an Apple store.
Really?
Philip Morris does say this isn't big with the teens in the 47 or so international markets where it is available. But if you talk to marketing and tobacco watchdogs, you hear that it's impossible to expect cigarette manufacturers to resist kind of the siren call of marketing to young people. I mean, look at the last 40 years.
Yeah. So do you think people, older people or younger people or whomever, are actually going to smoke these things? If that's the right word, that may not be the right word. Use these things.
I think this speaks to a bigger existential problem for Philip Morris writ large, USA and international. In the time that it took to get this heat not burn device approved, Juul, we know, came out of nowhere and annexed swaths of cigarette and vaping market share.
Right.
And with the parent of Philip Morris USA now owning a big chunk of Juul, it's going to create some cognitive dissonance internally about which way you go. Do you destroy your traditional cigarette market by doubling down on these two alternative technologies? And what happens if Philip Morris reemerges with Philip Morris USA? Which technology do you push out globally?
When will we see these things in stores?
You're going to see it rolled out here first in Atlanta, and you'll likely see it pushed out to the rest of the country in the latter half of the year and in 2020.
All right. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, good to speak with you as always.
Likewise, Peter. Take care.
This weekend, a new museum devoted to remembering the Civil War opens its doors in Richmond, Virginia. The American Civil War Museum sits on the banks of the James River, which was important to the Confederacy during the war. So what new is there to say about a war that ended more than 150 years ago? Joining me now are historians Ed Ayers and Joanne Freeman, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back to both of you.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
And Ed, now we know what you've been doing in your free time, because you are not just an expert on the Civil War, but also the founding chair of the board of this new museum. So first of all, congratulations on the opening.
Thanks very much. We're very excited.
And what is it that this museum is trying to say that is new about the Civil War?
Well, we're trying to tell the story as fully as it can be told. We're trying to include everybody in the story, white and black and northern and southern and men and women and soldier and civilian, before, during, and after, and really integrating the social and cultural with the military and the political history in a way that you don't see.
Joanne, the Civil War is a topic that is often misunderstood.
Well, it is, and I think that's for a whole bunch of reasons. I think one of them is people tend to look at it in isolation as this sort of blob of conflict in the middle of the 19th century, you know, when it obviously has extremely deep roots in any number of things in the American tradition, slavery being first and foremost among them. So to understand the Civil War, you really actually do have to go back to the founding and even before to understand some of the things that it's rooted in.
Well, and that's the big question we'll start with, Ed. When people ask you what started the Civil War, what do you tell them?
Well, ask them to sit down first so that we can talk it through. You know, well, a poll recently showed that 40% of Americans think, when they are asked that question, that the Civil War was about states' rights. And that number has not really moved very much. Young people think that as much as older people, and northern people think it as much as southern people. And no historian has said this for 50 years, so it's alarming that we seem not to be able to get through. So here's what I say. Okay, why in the world would the South go to war over states' rights? What right exactly were they defending? And it doesn't take long to say, well, the right to take slavery across the rest of the United States. And I said, well, that doesn't mean that the war is really kind of over slavery, right? It's over the future of slavery. But it's very easy to give very quick and shallow answers about all this. So I try to tell people, look, this is an unbalanced equation. The North does not go to war to end slavery, because that was impossible. They could not have destroyed the largest economic stake in the United States. They could not have imagined doing that. But that doesn't mean that the South did not go to war to defend it. So we have to understand, this is what the new museum does, it shows that this is a story, that it starts one way and then unfolds and becomes something else. So people need to get over the idea that you can sort of weigh out different proportions, that it was about one thing or another. Instead, it was a story in which its meanings were unfolding.
Well, Ed, the museum is in Virginia, and I wonder, because you'll probably have people coming there both from the North and the South, whether most of the people who don't want to say that it's about slavery are people who were raised in the South.
Yeah, you'd think so, but like I said, these polls don't show that's the case. So the museum has interesting genealogy. We merged the former Museum of the Confederacy, which has the largest collection of Civil War artifacts in private hands in the world, with the American Civil War Center, which is telling the story in this progressive way. And so that's what we've been working on the last 6 years, is combining a 100-year-old museum whose origins lay in the lost cause with a vision of a place that's going to tell the story more fully than it's been told anywhere. One thing I point out to people is that Richmond was not only the capital of the Confederacy, it was also the place within which 40% of all the men who died in the Civil War died within 150 miles of Richmond. It's the Normandy of the North, as well as the capital of the Confederacy, and it's the center of the domestic slave trade. Virginia is the largest slave state. So what we try to show people is you can't pull those strands apart. You can't just sort of come in with the assumption that you have this theory and it's going to be tested. Instead, we hope really, and this museum is going to blow people's minds, is the technical term that I would use. It shows how it was a completely shattering experience. And we're trying to shatter your understanding of the Civil War when you come in. So it's a bold statement that it's not in sepia. It doesn't have violins and fiddles in the backgrounds. It's about today.
Well, let's talk about that, Joanne. The current political debate does often end up going back to debates that have been around since the Civil War.
Well, right. And particularly, you know, I mean, there are moments, I think, generally speaking, in American history that touch more profoundly on some of the deeper meanings of what the United States is and what it means. And I think we're engaged in one of those moments, and that's bringing in its train a lot of discussion about founding narratives and founding ideals and things like museums or monuments or statues, all of the things that people are really fraught about at the moment.
Yeah, people trust museums more than any other form of knowledge about the past, except maybe our brief appearances on Here and Now, which I think people would see as the anchors. But museums have a special responsibility for, just as Joanne was saying, here are concrete things, you know. So we have a Confederate flag when you come into the museum, but it's the Confederate flag that was given to Tad Lincoln when he visited, when Richmond fell, and came there with his father. We have an iron hand that was the model of an African-American man that he made himself from the iron that he is forging in this iron foundry that is where the museum is located. So I think, you know, one reason that people are skeptical that the North went to war against slavery is people can't imagine the North had the moral fortitude to do such a thing now. People look and see how pervasive racism is throughout the country, how, you know, it seems everywhere you look that forces are arrayed against African-American people, so that they have a hard time imagining that at some time there were people who were willing to give their lives to end slavery. So it's not just to kind of come in and, you know, deflate things. It's also to remind people that some people fought for the highest ideals of this nation.
Are you going to do Civil War reenactments at the museum?
I don't know.
What was that reaction, Ed? Do you have a problem with Civil War reactions?
It was a problem. That means I don't really know the answer to that. But we won't do it in the way that that people think that Civil War reenactments are. For example, we have a young woman, a teenager, who is sitting at a table, and she's making something with her hands. And you start chatting with her, and it turns out that she is making cartridges. for use by the Confederate Army. She's on the island across the James from our museum. And as you talk to her, you realize that she was the one who set off the spark that killed dozens of people, including herself, in a horrible fire. Right?
Wow.
So is that a Civil War reenactment? Yeah. Is it hordes of middle-aged men coming over a ridge? No. So I think that gives you an example of how we're reimagining the Civil War, the cast of characters, but also the roles that people are playing.
You know, when you think back about the Civil War, part of the thought is this must have been really very difficult for people who lived through it and had to deal with, as you say, you know, having to go to war, perhaps give your life for a cause. On the other hand, when we look back at it from the perspective of the present, good thing we had the Civil War because we don't have slavery in this country anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's the profound ambivalence we have about it. You know, one thing I point out to people is things that are far worse than you can imagine can happen. And the outbreak of a war that killed the equivalent today of 8 million people, if the Civil War today had the same scale of loss. On the other hand, things that are far better than we can imagine, such as the end of the largest and most powerful system of slavery in the modern world. Both those things happen within these 4 years. And so it's not really surprising that we continue to struggle with it 150 years later, because it is such a complex legacy that we'll always continue to struggle with it. And that's okay.
That is Joanne Freeman and Ed Ayers, historians and co-hosts of the podcast Backstory. And Ed is the founding chair of the board of the new American Civil War Museum, which is opening this weekend in Richmond, Virginia. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks for having us.
Robin Young is on a reporting trip, and she sent us this remembrance.
All this week, I've been thinking of a young man I met in Los Angeles in 1990. We spent a lot of time walking and driving through his old neighborhood in South Central.
This is my old neighborhood.
Some people would look at this and see a blighted neighborhood. Now, what are you seeing?
A blighted neighborhood. What else? We used to play in this field over here.
Yeah.
Back in the day, over there, that used to be the world famous Century Drive-In. Yeah.
We used to sit up on the roof.
Century Drive-In, sit up on the roofs, and you can look at movies.
I smile now, thinking of him sneaking a peek at movies, because this was a 23-year-old John Singleton, and he was in the middle of making the earth-shattering movie, Boys in the Hood.
And now, the wondrous world of...
The film tells the haunting story of black families like the one John grew up in, trying to navigate an inner-city obstacle course of guns and gangs. A terrifying character in his film is a car in a drive-by shooting. As he told me, if he lived by the beach, he might have made it a shark, like Jaws, but he was afraid of drive-bys. He did live by the beach, really, but like many kids in South Central, he'd never been there, and it was only a couple of miles from home to Hollywood, but it was an implausible journey.
I mean, say one of your friends ends up getting shot or getting beat up, those are certain things that, you know, I went through. You got to evaluate whether or not what you're going to do is going to change your life, you know, because, I mean, my life, no matter what I'm doing right now, there are times in which I could have just gone another direction, and none of this would have ever happened. For one semester, I ended up getting bussed out to the Valley, and every white kid I knew wanted to be like Steven Spielberg. They all had 8mm cameras, and you know, I don't have no money to buy no 8mm camera. What I did, you know, I took little books and made little animated movies.
Those little movies got him into film school and to Columbia Pictures. He wrote and directed Boys, serious business, but when we visited him in post-production, he was still just a 23-year-old.
Spider-Man.
You could be the only Hollywood director finishing his film and reading Spider-Man.
I like Spider-Man. You know, this is cool and everything, but I'm happy I got a job, you know.
This is a job out of college.
Yeah, it's just a job out of college. Most of my friends, you know, they're unemployed, you know. You know, last year, I was starving. You know, now I got a house, so, and a full refrigerator.
Then, Boys in the Hood was picked for the Cannes Film Festival. John will be taking his first plane ride.
As a kid, did you even know about Cannes, or did you dream about it, or
no,
did you think about...
I didn't know about France. You know, I mean, you know what I'm saying? I didn't know about Idaho. You know, I mean, this would be the first time I've ever gone out of the country. So this would be interesting.
Strikes you about France?
Yeah, people talk differently.
Sur place de Madonna, certains
auront. What fun to witness this. Boys became the must-see film. John and his star Ice Cube applauded everywhere. He got to hang with his mentor and idol Spike Lee.
Yo.
I'm supposed to turn around, you say yo.
Yeah. I don't know nothing else, man. That works. I saw a French dude do that.
Mm-hmm. And also Newsweek wants to do a phoner with you from Los Angeles.
Okay, well, when would you have time, maybe?
But we also watched the industry embrace turn into a suffocating hug.
What's the stupidest question so far?
Stupidest question so far is, are you a black director?
There's renaissance now for black filmmakers. Is this just a fashion that we're seeing now, or is this the future?
You are Spike Lee, is that right?
No, I'm not Spike Lee.
Who are you? I'm sorry. Who are you?
I'm John Singleton. Oh, God. This is a circus, isn't it?
Then back home, the film was released. On the first night, there was violence in several theaters. One man was killed.
Yeah, let's talk. A lot has changed, huh?
Oh,
so much has changed.
How are you feeling?
I feel a little bit older. I think I lost about 5 years of my life. I mean, you know, I'm kind of hurt.
Those people are my family, and I'm not going to turn my back on them. And I don't want them turning their back on me by causing trouble while my film is showing.
John Singleton would go on to be nominated for Best Director, the youngest person and first African-American to get that nomination. In 2002, the Library of Congress deemed his film culturally and historically significant.
I would consider success, you know, somebody goes to my movie, you know, some young brother that has a baby and says, yo, man, you know, I saw your movie, I know what you was trying to say and everything and stuff, and, you know, I'm taking care of my son, you know, I'm taking care of my daughter. I just want you to know I was really inspired. That, for me, is, you know, worth more than anything.
Filmmaker John Singleton at 23. He passed away Monday after a stroke at the age of 51. A life and a career that ended way too soon, but we just wanted to share how it started. I'm Robin Young.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.